November 10th, 2014. Episode.
Oh, I see. Isn't it number 12?
Episode 12? Could very well be.
And
on the air.
Oh, we haven't filled the water glasses.
Yeah. Go ahead, Henry.
Well, you, at the end of the last session, you asked me in so many words whether there wasn't anything that could have been done about the, what I call the burning of the books. That is to say, after 100 copies had been mimeographed of this 750-page tome, and they were ordered destroyed by my mentor, if that is the right word, for Dr. Edward S. Rogers, M.D.
Because of one or two sentences that might not have even been in there, right?
No, that's not right. There was a chapter called The Social Structure, which he, I don't believe, ever read, but thought was an impassioned plea on behalf of organizing farm workers to get rid of the Bracero program. And there was absolutely nothing like that in there.
Why did he think that?
Because he was still paranoid about the purple prose of my ten-page screed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as he put it in one of the sessions in which he tried to be fatherly or avuncular or whatever, he said that my problem was, what's the word, infraconemphilia, which is Greek for love of the underdog. He thought I had that sickness. Well, certainly there is something to be said for that. But anyway, to get back to the reason why I don't believe I fully answered your question, one of the reasons I didn't, at the time at least, make any real protest about the burning of the books is what happened at a meeting, the final meeting of the advisory committee of my research project. I don't believe that I went into any detail on that subject, but it took the heart out of me because there was nobody on the entire committee who said so much as, well, if that chapter is out of place or objectionable in any for any reason, why not just excise it? Because it was not crucial to the purpose of the study, which was to answer the question of whether Bracero's being in this country for a period of months was having any effect on their thinking about how to maintain health and what to do when you get sick. Everybody on the committee went along with Rogers' edict, which was to destroy the entire thing. Well, it was particularly hurtful that my old friend from the University of Hawaii, Herbert Bloomer, who by then was the chairman of the sociology department at Berkeley, agreed that I went beyond the proper subject in discussing the power structure at work that accounted for the existence of the Bracero program. Well, I didn't want to get into an argument with Herb Bloomer at this meeting, but at the very first meeting of the advisory committee, way back in the summer of 56, and here it was, 1960, he himself had said that I should put the whole subject of the Bracero program within a social context. So I thought I was just following his instructions. But the fact that I didn't have a single defender just, as I say, took whatever fight there might have been out of me. It wasn't until some years later that I entered the fray once again. Anyway, so much for the subject of my 750-page report, which brings us to May of 1960, in which a number of other things were going on within the farm labor movement and within AWOC in particular, because of course during the months up to that point, I had been splitting my time between two virtually full-time jobs, one working on this manuscript and the other my duties as director of research for AWOC. Well, in the spring of 1960, as happens every year, the cherries become ripe in the Stockton area, and Stockton is at least at that time, was the nation's number one producer of Bing cherries. They had a virtual monopoly on the national market. And of course, this was one of my arguments in a number of my AWOC research papers, which was if only the growers of these various crops would band together and take advantage of their potential power in the marketplace, they could very easily give whatever the growers considered a living wage. But the growers competed among themselves and never did take advantage of their potential powers. But in the spring of 1960, a voice was heard from a source that hadn't been before, and that was the workers who called themselves fruit tramps. They also sometimes called themselves rubber tramps because they went from one fruit harvest to another by automobile. And they were sometimes known as ladder tramps because that was their place within the farm labor hierarchy. They specialized in fruit crops, which required that you climb up ladders. Which brings into play two skills, neither of which is simple, as I know from personal experience. One is how to place and work from ladders without falling off and hurting yourself, and placing it in such a way that you can reach the maximum number of ripe fruit before you have to move the ladder again. And then secondly, it takes even more skill in recognizing the distinction between fruit that is not quite ripe and that which is ready. And there's particular skill in the case of cherries, because you have not only to recognize the ripeness of the fruit, but you have to pick the fruit with a stem attached to it. Otherwise, it will spoil rapidly and your fruit will be thrown out by a grater before you even get credit for picking that particular bucket. So, these very highly skilled fruit tramps, and believe me, that is not a term of denigration. They call themselves that. Fruit tramps, ladder tramps, rubber tramps, all the same thing. They are the elite of farm workers. The growers have found that growers of that time, when this was, of course, the time in which growers were trying to use brassaros to the greatest extent possible. Growers tried using brassaros in some of these fruit crops and found that they were no great bargain, because they would damage the trees, they would pick fruit that was not ready for picking, and it had to be thrown out. And so it was to their advantage to continue to use fruit tramps year after year after year. And in the spring of 1960, because there was in existence in the Stockton area a union, the fruit tramps talked among themselves and they said, what's a union for if not to represent us and to get us an increase in the pay we get for picking cherries? And so they essentially organized themselves and came to AWOC and said, we want representation. And Norman Smith, who was nominally in charge, said, okay, what do you want? And they said, we want $1.10 a bucket instead of a dollar. And that certainly sounded reasonable. So AWOC said a strike was in effect. And on the side of the workers was another element which hadn't been really a factor in the past, and that was a state agency called the Mediation and Reconciliation Service of the State Department of Industrial Relations, which exists for the practice, for the purpose of bringing together workers and employers to at least talk with each other. As the name of the organization suggests, they had no powers to enforce an agreement, but they did serve to try to get people conversing at least. And so they came into the cherry harvest of San Joaquin County. And they did, in fact, get some of the smaller growers talking with the union with the understanding that they weren't being required to sign contracts. All they were being asked to do was pay $1.10 a bucket for picking cherries. And a number of them went along with that. But the biggest cherry grower in the county, and probably in the country, maybe the world, was a guy named Fred Podesta. Had 900 acres of cherries, I believe. And he said, oh no. He would let the camel's nose inside the tent, and it would end up with our being forced to recognize the Union, and there'd be no end of it. So he drew a line in the sand, as they say, and held out, paying no more than a dollar. And he wasn't able to get workers. And he lost a big chunk of his crop. I don't know, $100,000 or whatever. I suspected that he might have been helped with his losses by his friends in the cherry growing business and perhaps other fruit growing businesses, because it lent weight to their claim that without an adequate supply of labor, they were going to be forced to let crops rot in the fields. That was the mantra that they used. And so he did let a lot of cherries go to waste. And of course, took all the advantage that he could in the popular press that here was good food, this highly desirable food. People loved cherries. And they thought they were getting good publicity out of the fact here was the Union forcing them to let good food waste. Anyway, this was a time of considerable stress for Norman Smith, the director of AWOC. And in fact, he turned over the running of the strike to Lewis Cranock, who was sort of self-designated. I mean, he created the title for himself of Director of Public Relations and Training. So he had charge of training the organizers as well as handling the relations with the press and the public. And he ran the unions because Norman Smith suffered what he claimed was a flare-up of his diabetes, and he went to the hospital. But Cranock always told us that Smith was simply out of his depth in trying to cope with the press and went to the hospital to avoid the problems of dealing with the strike. In so many words, he claimed that Smith was simply chickening out. I did not have any great... I had no respect for Cranock then or later, because he was an opportunist, kind of an Iago-type figure behind the throne, manipulating and stabbing Smith in the back every way he could. The crop ran its course, and as usual, the Union had nothing lasting to show for it. As part of my job, I was told to calculate how much extra money went into the pockets of the cherry pickers because of the fact that most of the growers did go along with their wage request of $1.10 a bucket. I was able to come kind of with a plausible figure of some millions of dollars. And Smith always liked to use those kinds of data to show that the union was a great success. But there was no guarantee that any such benefits would continue in future years. Sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. Now, another development of some interest, and another reason why Smith came close to having a nervous breakdown, was the revival of an old problem that began in the 1940s with an effort back then to organize farm workers under the aegis of a union called the NAWU, the National Agricultural Workers Union, which in its own way was the successor of the Southern Tenant Farmers Union way back in the 30s. Sharecroppers tried to organize themselves. And I can't go into the history of all of this. But in the late 1930s, the late 40s, the NAWU tried to organize the DiGiorgio Fruit Corporation, probably the biggest single grower in the state of California and therefore in the country and probably the world. It had holdings up and down the San Joaquin Valley of various kinds. Their main base of operations was in Kern County. And the NAWU struck their home ranch under the leadership of Ernesto Galarza, whom I later became a very good friend of. The only PhD ever to be an officer of a national union, so far as we know. Very brilliant guy, but didn't know much about the practicalities of farm labor. He knew a lot about the economics of agriculture, but not the nitty-gritty. So he went about the organizing in a traditional way, just set up picket lines at the entrances of the DiGiorgio ranch, and there are a number of entrances in a huge multi-acre ranch of that sort. So they were at some pains to have enough pickets to maintain any kind of showing. But they tried to get all the advantages they could out of the David versus Goliath metaphor. Here they were, a tiny little union against the biggest agricultural corporation of them all. And they tried to keep up these token picket lines enough to attract a certain amount of attention. They attracted the attention of the left wing of the motion picture industry, And those friends of the labor movement put together a documentary called Poverty in the Valley of Plenty, which found no difficulty in going into the fields and taking pictures of bad housing and workers stooping over all day in the hot sun and kids in rags and so forth and so on, all with the implication that these were the conditions on the DiGiorgio Ranch. And in fact, they weren't even allowed access to the DiGiorgio property. And if they had been, they probably would have found that the conditions on the DiGiorgio Ranch were not all that bad. But the DiGiorgio Fruit Corporation sued under libel laws that they had been defamed by this documentary. And they had a lot of money for high-powered lawyers, and the union didn't have any, and so DiGiorgio won. They had sued for $2 million. I don't think they collected any monetary damages at all. But they did obtain a court order that the union had to gather up all existing copies of this documentary and turn them over to the company, to which the union agreed, including Galarza as an officer of the union. Come 1960, Cranach, as director of public relations and training of the staff of AWOC, got hold of a copy of this supposedly non-existent motion picture and started showing it at meetings of AWOC, wherever he could organize them. And I went to one myself. I didn't think it was a particularly good documentary, but there weren't very many good documentaries about farm labor organizing. I don't think there were any. So Cranach showed it rather widely until DiGiorgio heard about it and prepared by having a number of his personal witnesses attend one of these public showings. It was held in a farm labor camp, but they were open to people without having to show any IDs. And these guys probably put on the closest thing they had to working men's clothes. So they took notes on exactly what was said and the fact that the movie had been shown in its entirety, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and went back to their corporate headquarters in San Francisco and prepared a lawsuit, very similar, almost identical, I think, to the one that had been filed back in 1949. Again, asking for $2 million in damages, and naming Norman Smith as the principal defendant, Ernesto Galarza as the second. The organization AWOC and the organization, the NAWU, as organizational defendants. And then a number of John Does, which would consist of the staff members who had attended these showings. I was never named as a defendant, although I was a staff member who had attended at least one of the showings, but somehow or other I escaped their net. Now, ironically enough, Galarza himself had resigned from his position with AWOC in January of that year because he was so disgruntled with Norman Smith and the relationship between the way the farm workers and the packing house workers were being treated under the charter of AWOC. On paper, AWOC was supposed to sign up field workers for membership in the NAWU. Hello? Nobody here. Goodbye. And anybody who was a member of the packing house workers, anybody engaged in the packing, sorting and crating and packing of produce would be turned over to the packing house workers union. In actual practice, Norman Smith didn't divide anybody into either one of them. He kept all the dues paid into a trust fund to be fought over later. And it essentially meant the starvation of the NAWU, and Galarza considered his primary loyalty to that organization, and so he resigned from AWOC. And he got himself dismissed from the lawsuit on the grounds that he was totally uninformed about the fact this motion picture had been shown and would have opposed it if he had known about it, because he knew that this court order was still in existence, that it was not to be shown by anybody. But Norman Smith was still on the hook for $2 million, at least in theory. And that lawsuit dragged on for months and months and months. Well, I was trying to continue functioning in my writing of research papers and whatever I could do to make myself useful. And then on Thursday, the 30th day of June of 1960, there occurred a number, one of the watershed events in my career, my whole life. And at this point, I would like to go off the record. I do not want this portion of whatever I might say to be transcribed. Because before we ever began these sessions, Eugene might possibly remember that I said I had no intention of going into details about my recurring problems with the fair sex. At the time that I said that, I believed that it was perfectly legitimate because I didn't think that there was that much connection. I thought that my career choices, well, let's put it this way. I thought that the course of my life broke down into two really fundamental quests. One was for the hunt for some way in which I could make a difference in the world, a difference in the direction of what I considered to be humane values. And the other main course was a hunt for a lasting love. And that the two were not really interdependent or intertwined in some fundamental way. Well, that was my theory, at least, in thinking about it more fully. I don't think it is possible to fully disentangle them. A really complete biography would go into both, but that would require the skill of Charles Dickens or somebody. And so I'm going to continue to try to keep them independent to the extent possible. I've also thought that there are differences in that many of the details of my attempt to make for social changes of one kind or another are documented, for better or for worse. I myself wrote the cry from the heart that got me into so much trouble. And I have copies of all the letters that followed that, in which the representatives of these government agencies tried to force me to retract my statements and to apologize, etc., 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 and my attempt to placate them. All of that's available. Whereas there's no documentation of declarations of love and repudiations of such declarations, that all those matters of the heart remain in the heart. Thirdly, all of this I now have had time to think about more fully since I talked with Eugene at the very beginning. I now realize that most of the people I had troubles with back in my fights with the university and the growers' organizations and so forth, and later on, we haven't even come to my problems with the pesticide industry and the medical industry. But most of my sparring partners, if that's the word, are dead. That is, in that portion of my life. Whereas many of the people that I had problems with in matters of the heart are still alive. And no useful purpose could be served by trying to go over those dead embers. Whereas a lot of ill feeling might result from it, and therefore I don't intend to do it. So suffice it to say that on Thursday of June 30th, 1960, I apparently had some commitment to go to a staff meeting or something beyond the usual end of the work day. I didn't keep any regular hours ever. So I worked late doing something. I can't remember exactly. In those days, I didn't keep a diary, which I later began. In fact, I told Pam that I would eat before I got home. So I went to a Greasy Spoon restaurant in the Skid Row area of Stockton, where I could get a bowl of soup and a plate of hash and a couple of slices of bread and a cup of tea for 25 cents. A bargain so obvious I couldn't overlook it. So it was getting to be dark by the time I got back to 1820 Ramona Avenue in Stockton, and found that the lights were out. And when I opened the door, I found nobody there and no note. And no kids' clothing or toys or anything. And I sank to my knees and felt that it was the end of the world. But eventually I became able to think, and I had to assume that it hadn't been a matter of abduction by kidnappers or anything like that. I tried to think who would know where they had gone, and I called my mother, and she knew and said that I shouldn't do anything desperate, that they were okay, they were in San Jose with the kids' grandparents. Well, I was in no condition to drive up to Sacramento. And I wasn't going to spend the night there by myself. And all I could think of was my friend and spiritual counselor, Father McCullough. I guess it was some kind of spiritual intervention that he was present at his church, whereas normally he would have been out saying Mass at a Bracero camp, which he did almost every weeknight, spending the weekends with his church in the outskirts of Stockton. But he was in his own church that night, and I got right through to him. I said to him, "Father, I need you. Can you come over here right away?" And he did. And he took me back with him to his church and saw me through that night. Now, I'll just say one other thing before I'll drop the subject. And that is that I somehow said I had to compartmentalize myself between the continuation of serving the movement and dealing with this great shock in my personal life, and that I needed to begin doing that sooner rather than later, And therefore, I forced myself to go through with an appointment that I had the following morning, Friday, July 1st. I was supposed to speak at a meeting of some church group in Modesto on the subject of the moral and ethical implications of the farm worker organizing drive, something to that effect. And there I was the following morning speaking on that subject before I allowed myself to begin thinking how to establish contact with my kids. Anyway, I kept going on the union almost without interruption. But the other side of my life was never the same again. Now, I didn't know how long any of this was going to take this afternoon, and therefore I don't have an agenda to fill out the rest of the time. I would be prepared to go back on the record if I had anything particular to say about... Okay, here's something I can say. I forgot to mention. During the course... We're back on the record now.
Okay.
During the course of this cherry workers' strike, and I call it the workers' strike rather than the union strike because it was really... essentially the idea of the workers themselves, which dragged the union along with it, with them. Somehow, I think it was unplanned. A television crew from CBS, which had a big chunk of money to do a documentary which was going to be part of a series to be narrated by the famous broadcaster Edward R. Murrow. They were going to do a documentary about the plight of the migrant farm workers, as they called it. And they even had a title picked out. It was going to be called Harvest of Shame. And they were going to prepare this documentary to be shown at the Thanksgiving season of that year. And somehow or other, they had it so that their television crew was there in Stockton at the very time of this cherry strike. They could not have known about it in advance, so as I say, it was fortuitous, or if you prefer, providential, whatever. To his credit, because he was pretty good at this sort of thing, Cranock put together a rally of a lot of these fruit tramps. I can't recall exactly what auditorium he arranged for them, but he had a goodly crowd there. He also had the services of a fellow named Ernie Mars. I mentioned Ernie Mars at the last session, a friend of Pete Seeger's, who wanted to be the Pete Seeger of the current generation in appearing at union rallies. And he had his big moment. He sang at this particular rally a song that he himself invented for the occasion. Keep your eye upon the dollar and a dime for every pail, set to some well-known tune. I can't remember exactly which tune. I remember those words. And as you know, I guess, when a crew goes into the field and takes pictures of that, of this sort of thing, 90 or 95% of it ends up on the cutting room floor. But they saved that portion of the rally that featured Ernie Mars, and it was the high point of his life. And the documentary itself attracted a lot of attention when it showed at the Thanksgiving season of that year. It wasn't particularly good, in my opinion, because, in fact, most farm workers were not migrants, and the repetition of this cliché, the plight of the migrants, was rather misleading, in my opinion. But it not only did it attract attention that year, but it kept being shown for many successive Thanksgivings. I don't know what ever became of it, but I'm sure you can still get copies of it from Amazon if you're so inclined. So that was a big development. I give Cranach some credit for doing that, because all of this was during the time that poor Norm Smith was in the hospital. And if I have another, and I do have a few more minutes, I want to say a few words about Norman Smith himself. He was very, very kind and generous to me after the cataclysm in my own life. I wasn't able to spend any time at Ramona Avenue at all. So Norm Smith had me sleeping on the floor of his apartment as long as I wanted. So I had a sleeping bag, and I made myself at home to whatever extent was possible. And it was no problem with Smitty himself, because he was always up and out way before I woke up to harangue his friends down on Skid Row. I don't know what he did with his evenings, but he was... I almost never saw him in his apartment. But he was very kind to me, as he had been in allowing me unlimited time to continue my work with the Bracero study for the university. I guess part of it is that he didn't really know what a director of research might otherwise be doing. As I think I have said before, He essentially let me define the job for myself. As for his ideas about organizing, how to organize farm workers, all he knew was what might be called the collective approach, was to try to get a crowd and orate, and with the power of the spoken word, perhaps magnified by a bullhorn outside of a factory gate or something of that sort, you might be able to move a number of people all at the same time. It's one approach. He was very good at that. If he had ever been able to find an analogous situation to a factory gate in agriculture, but he never was able to find one. And the other basic approach was one-on-one, which he had also used to good effect, and that's how he had recruited his boss, John or Jack Livingston, who became director of the entire Department of Organizing for the AFL-CIO. But he never had any experience with the between those two opposite extremes was a small group, the house meeting, which is what some of us had hoped he would use as the basic technique in the organizing of farm workers. So he wasn't to be blamed for the fact he had no feeling for it. He just had never seen it in actual operation. And thirdly, I had fellow feelings for Norman Smith, because he was in a situation very similar to the one that I had put myself in as the head of the titular head of the student body at Pali High. Norman Smith had had the right to tell Jack Livingston he didn't know enough about farm workers at the age of 62, and he was an old dog, he wasn't capable of learning new tricks, and therefore, thanks for thinking of me, Jack, but I'm just going to continue serving as foreman of a crew at the Fontana Steelworks until I retire in 3 years, and I'll make do with my memories of the glory years in the 1930s. He had the right to turn his back on the job of director of AWOC, but he hadn't done so, and there he was trapped in something that he knew he wasn't doing a good job of it, and it made him miserable, but he was stuck with it. So I felt for him. I felt very sorry for him. He and I became friends. I never had the opportunity to say what I thought about any of his activities or his proposals. If I had had such a chance, he might have listened to them, but he wouldn't have paid any attention to them. I had an effect later on, and we'll come to that in time. As I say, there was a considerable period in which the real power of the organization was held by Lou Cranach, and it's a very interesting fact that every history of the farm labor movement, and there have been many, and there continue to be many, and every one of them is entirely missing in this aspect, that the power behind the throne for a considerable period of time was Louis F. Cranach. He's a forgotten man, and as far as I'm concerned, he deserves to be. But if I were ever to write my history, he would be there. For better or for worse, he deserves to have, because of his influence. As it is, Ilarza is always mentioned more prominently than he should, I think. He had really no impact at all upon AWOC. Ann Smith is mentioned, of course, but all of the histories are deficient, in my opinion. It's a little late in the day now for me to write a book about it, but that's it for today. Unless you have any...
I think maybe that song is... the refrain is, keep your hand upon the throttle and your eyes upon the rail.
There you go.
I don't know the rest. Do you know that?
No, I don't.
Okay. It's a folk song.
I'll look into that.
Okay, thanks very much.